Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's written several books, A Radically Beneficial World, Automation Technology and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? He's America's philosopher, we call him. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure to discuss the big topics of the day with you.
Great. And I thought today we'd do a focus on your recent writings, which range from a number of topics. Initially, let's look at exploring the Fed's loss of credibility, and then we can move into the Fed's failure of letting inflation get way ahead of their tightening, and also their failure to understand that inflation is now embedded for structural reasons, so looking more like structural inflation, secular inflation, versus what they initially termed as transitory inflation. And we can delve into what's happening on a global supply view, and what the supply chain challenges are, labor issues, all contributing to that. So maybe we begin with your view on the Fed's loss of credibility.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. And I think the loss of credibility of the Federal Reserve is, I think it's actually both a loss of personal integrity, you know, a loss of faith in their personal integrity of the Fed governors, and a loss of faith in their policies and the policies' effectiveness. And that would include, you know, them missing inflation or getting behind inflation, which I believe is evidenced by the recent rise in yields, right? Like the market is basically saying that we don't believe that the Fed has 100% control, as they claim. But in terms of personal credibility, it's really quite striking that the Federal Reserve from the last 13 years, from the 2008 subprime bubble bursting and the global financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has maintained this very enviable, if undeserved, reputation as saviors of, you know, the global economy, and, you know, many of the Fed leaders have been put on magazine covers and all this kind of thing, lauded as heroes of the financial world. And then now we discover that they're trading millions or tens of millions of dollars on their personal account right before they announce policies that are going to move the market. And so this is just a corruption, plain and simple, right? And everybody understands that. And so this is the first dent in the Fed's sort of like godlike aura of power, and the idea that they're really working hard to, you know, protect the common worker, and, you know, this is their sort of PR. And so this really is now called into question, and I think it's inescapable and that their credibility has now been lost. And I would this is somewhat of an analogy, but it's kind of like when you lose trust in an institution or a partner, then that cannot be restored quickly, right? Or if ever. And so I think the Fed's lost a tremendous amount of credibility in the public's eye, and a few of the worst, most corrupt people retiring or quitting doesn't erase that damage to their credibility.
Yeah. And also the idea of what's happening on their monetary policy, right? And I mean, they've been repressing interest rates for quite a period of time. And now, you know, it looks like inflation is beginning to take off. Initially, they termed it as transitory inflation, but do you agree that it may look more like secular inflation for structural reasons?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've written a number of columns, blog posts about this, the sources of secular structural inflation. And you mentioned before we started recording the one that was published on Zero Hedge today about I was making arguments that the structure of this global supply chain itself, it basically ensures permanent scarcities and shortages because redundancy and competition has been wrung out of the system for efficiency purposes and to maximize profits. And so there's just a huge amount of incentive in that structure to maintain scarcity because, of course, then you get the scarcity premium. That's how you make a profit. Right. You can. And we're seeing this. I'm hearing this from readers who are involved in the end part of the supply chain that prices are jumping up for components 40%. Right. Or more, doubling, tripling. And then say even the big toy manufacturers, that are trying to bring in toys for Christmas from China. They're already saying that their transportation and costs are now 40% of their retail price, and it used to be 7%. So what percentage gain is that? Mm-hmm. And so, anyways, that's just one example. You have other sources of structural scarcities in that are driving up costs.
Yeah, exactly. And just to give everyone the title on your blog post, it's Why Shortages Are Permanent: Global Supply Shortages Make Fantastic Financial Sense. So that's a great post that you have there. But we were making a list just before our discussion of both sides of the equation, demand side, supply side, and there's a lot of factors going on now that seem to indicate, all of the forces in the direction of inflation. Some of these are short-term, some of these are long-term, but certainly the resurgent demand is there on the demand side of the equation due to the economy coming back from all of the COVID-related lockdowns and sort of restrictions on the economy. So we've got resurgent demand happening. At the same time, you've got a lot of supply chain shortages. And some of those supply chain shortages have to do with labor, significant labor reductions or issues, challenges. There's several categories that I can think of that are happening now. And, if you look at the vaccinated versus unvaccinated, on both sides of that, there are issues. So you've got many unvaxxed people are not willing to get vaxxed as part of some maybe employment or whatever. So they're leaving their employment willingly, or just outright quitting, or maybe even they're getting fired or let go or going on unpaid leave indefinitely is another scenario. So that's happening, on the unvax side. On the vax side, a lot of the vaxxed are getting COVID, it appears. There's a lot of statistics coming out in that regard. Many are getting sick, but also many are getting sick with regards to the vaccine's adverse side effects. So that's also adding to sidelined resources, right, working in the economy. So overall, you've got this labor shortage out there in the business, sectors that is contributing to this. So less labor, higher demand. Plus, you've got government procedures, additional burdening and costly procedures due to COVID that have been placed on businesses. Must do this, must do that, must have this in place, maybe something needs to be purchased as well. So all of that contributes to a higher cost of doing business. Of course, we talked in prior podcasts about the movements that is happening in terms of nationally and internationally. So nationally, you've got an exodus out of the cities into the suburbs and even into the countryside. So you've sort of less labor pool in the city areas generally. But also you've got brain drain and wealth drain happening overall on an international basis as people look to go where, you know, areas may have more opportunities or more freedom of movement. And then you've got people taking early retirement above this. They're making a decision, a life choice to do early retirement. So that's taking away from the labor pool. And then also there's a factor as well, that I would say is being contributed by several initiatives, by different organizations, even, and governments, World Economic Forum, the Great Reset Agenda. All of this is putting, burden on especially fossil fuels, coal, you know, those type of energy. Maybe there's regulations being placed or more burdening restrictions, which is raising the cost much higher. You can see the rise going now in prices of oil, different fossil fuels, natural gas. Of course, you've got the Russia situation, which, you know, in terms of the pipeline, which may be due to either a lack of infrastructure for supplying that natural gas, or even geopolitical factors that might be happening as well. Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. I think I think I'll add a few just details to your excellent list of labor issues that are pushing the cost of labor much higher on a secular, you know, systemic basis. As you mentioned, the early retirement, I read somewhere that the baby boom generation, of course, took the opportunity or was forced to retire in last year's lockdown. And of course, once they're retired, they're not coming back to the labor force. And this is several million people and in the U.S. And, you know, you multiply that globally and it's a pretty big number. And I also want to mention that the we've discussed it before, that part of the migration to suburbs and the countryside is a desire to work from home and a willingness to find some other way to make money if rather than go back to a full time corporate job, you know. And so, you know, the gig economy, which we've often mentioned, I've seen numbers as high as 60 million people. I don't know if that's accurate, but let's say it's wrong by half. 30 million would still be a significant percentage of people who have developed some kind of income stream from the informal or gig economy. And so I think that refusal to go back to a normal office job is also a factor in the restriction of the labor pool. And, you know, you read a lot of stories anecdotally about people putting out job, offers, and, you know, say 30 people respond, but only two show up for the interview. And when they're offered the job, then they don't actually show up for the job the next day. And so I think you're getting like kind of a bottom of the barrel kind of thing where I think employers are finding that the best workers have made other arrangements. And so the actual pool of people who are qualified and have all those traits that employers value, they've already been stripped out of the labor pool. And I want to mention real quickly on your resurgent demand point, we also have inventory build, right? That which is like this gaping hole globally in inventories that's still not been filled, right? And you know, there are people are talking about Christmas is already over in many ways because people don't have even the paper to print their catalogs, never mind the inventory to sell. And so, and I'm hearing a lot of anecdotal evidence of this from like bicycle parts to electronic components. I mean, there's just none available. And so everybody that can get access is trying to overorder, right, to build inventory. And so then you've got, that's a form of commercial hoarding, right? And then you've got consumer hoarding, where people are realizing that they better fill their own personal household inventory. And so we have these additional pressures on the supply side. So, and then to your point about coal and oil being restricted, it's an extremely interesting phenomenon that the ideology of wanting to transition to intermittent power like wind and solar is strong, but the practicalities are that's not possible. You know, that you have to have fossil fuel backup for when the intermittent power sources are insufficient. And so I just saw an article that said the global oil and gas, you know, hydrocarbon industry is not investing enough to maintain supply in 2022. In other words, it costs, they estimated $500 billion a year in investment in order to maintain current production, because of course, depletion is a factor. And so right now the numbers are about $300 billion. So there's a shortfall in the investment that's required to keep oil and gas and coal production at current levels. So if we're already short now, what happens when production actually falters and declines by 5 or 10%?
Yeah, those are great points. Are there any ideas or suggestions that the consumer can take to mitigate these effects, you know, in terms of their lifestyle choices, the type of work they do, perhaps where they live, or how they live?
Yeah, well, that's a great topic, Richard. And I think that there's lots of ideas out there, but I guess I would start by sort of stipulating that, you know, inflation of the kind we're talking about, the steady drip, 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 it hits the bottom 80% of the workforce that depends on their earnings the hardest, because they don't really have investment opportunities to make up the difference in the erosion of the purchasing power of their wages. And so that's why it's just so pernicious, you know, inflation, right, once it's secular. In terms of how to mitigate it, of course, number one is just stop wasting. And of course, it's a famous statistic that Americans waste something like a third of all the food that's harvested and produced in America. And I'd say they waste a third of all the petroleum products, you know, for fuel. You know, people driving around more or less aimlessly to do errands that could be consolidated or shared with somebody else, and so on. So eliminate waste would be a good first step. And then number two, look at perhaps getting closer by moving your household closer to the actual sources of essentials. And I mention that because it's staggering when you think about how dependent every major urban core is on resources extracted or processed thousands of miles away. And so the transportation of all essentials from fuel, food, et cetera, into urban cores is actually a very fragile, vulnerable system, which anybody within those supply chains will tell you, you know, that there's like 3 days or something like that of petroleum, you know, fuel, food, et cetera, in most situations. And so if you move out of an urban core, which no longer produces anything, and you get closer to where actual essentials are being produced, you're much more resilient, because you're closer to the source as opposed to being entirely dependent on these long global supply chains to supply you the essentials you need to stay alive. So that's a big topic, but that's something that I think about, because people may have forgotten, but 100 years ago, major urban cores in like London and Paris they grew or supplied almost half of their of the food within the city borders. Now that would include the suburbs, but the point being, there was a lot of small gardens and chicken coops and rooftop things, and a lot of food was grown inside city limits, and that's much diminished now, right? And cities used to produce goods and as well as services, and now cities produce virtually nothing for environmental restrictions and various globalization and so on. So they're importing virtually everything. The only thing that cities produce is consumption. So that I would say, think about reducing your vulnerability to super long, fragile global supply chains.
And of course, your recommendation would be a revamping of monetary policy by central banks as well that are generating this inflation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we can look at the rise in yields as the market participants basically calling the Fed's bluff, that they clearly don't believe that the Fed can keep real world yields at near zero. And so we're seeing a rather surprising increase, like say in the 30-year bonds yield in the U.S. And so, you know, Richard, you mentioned the bond bubble or the bond situation in Europe as an example of the global impact of the failure of financial repression by central banks. Maybe you could speak a little bit to the bond and yield situation in Europe.
Yeah, in Europe, it's totally out of control. It's essentially a non-functioning bond market ever since about 2014 or so when they started to do negative interest rates. It's just, you know, totally non-functional. And if you look at all of the member countries in Europe, they're borrowing. And the net is actually not much of an asset base overall, all of these netted out debts. But the level, the sheer level is essentially a bubble, you know. So the bubble is more in the bond market than it is in the equities market.
Yeah. And so let's talk briefly about what happens as yields rise. In other words, what happens to fiscal stimulus and this enormous increase in debt, both household, corporate, and sovereign, you know, that everyone's been borrowing trillions to fund this and that. And so what happens is yields rise.
Yeah, and things could quickly get out of control. If yields rise, interest rates are rising on all types of debt, servicing, economic activity begins to slow down. You've got a lot of derivatives, you know, trillions in derivatives that are based on interest rates, like interest rate swaps, that could begin unraveling. So it's just a total mess. Now, of course, the central banks may elect to accelerate monetary policy through money printing, quantitative easing, essentially sacrificing the currency in an effort to maintain the interest rates in some sort of stability. But again, it all eventually leads to rising interest rates and rising inflation. Do you think that's where we're at now?
Yeah, I think so, Richard. And I think we probably should bring up the other aspect of the Fed losing control, essentially, or refusing to deal with inflation, is that it's creating negative effects. In other words, the Fed and other central banks' policies have all been, their claim is that it's supporting employment and all these good things, but in actual fact, it's been hyper accelerating wealth inequality, right? And people are now awakening to that, and you see the Federal Reserve being grilled by politicians and being denounced in status quo publications such as the Wall Street Journal that published some commentary that the Fed was too powerful, too political. And so we're seeing that there's limits, political limits, on what the Fed can get away with. And so I think that the cordon of possibilities or potential policy expansions is tightening around the Fed, both because they're now visibly identified as corrupt, and they've let inflation run away from them. So now they're going to be playing catch up, which means they'll have to raise interest rates to try to suppress inflation. And their policies have exacerbated wealth inequality to the point that it's now a political issue. So I don't see any of those constraints going away.
And you've also recently written about that as well, on America's soaring wealth while the social order unravels beneath our feet. Can you elaborate on that? You have a post entitled, "While Everyone Cheers Soaring Wealth, America's Social Order is Unraveling."
Right, right. And I think I can summarize my point there, which we all know. It's extremely visible, which is the wealth of the United States in particular, but I would say in the developed world as a whole, is, of course, concentrated in the top 5%. And within that, it's actually concentrated in the top 0.1% that owns a majority of the productive wealth. And so as the Fed and other central banks have created this asset bubble in real estate, stocks, and bonds, the beneficiaries are only the very top of the wealth power pyramid, right? And that the bottom 50% in the United States, the bottom 50% of households, have actually seen their meager share of the nation's wealth decline from like 1.2% to like 0.6. You know, while the top 5% is gaining tens of trillions of dollars in wealth, the bottom 50% have actually seen their meager share of the wealth actually fall in half. And so this is creating social disorders that we see in homelessness, the rise of mental health issues, the level of anger and aggression that's visible in everything from airline flights and passengers becoming disruptive to rising crime, and so on. And so we're seeing the social order unravel. And that means that social cohesion has been lost because of rising wealth inequality, which can be put directly on the step of the Federal Reserve.
Well, this is very challenging times that we live in. Any final thoughts on potential solutions or how we can address some of these challenges?
Well, yeah. That's a big one, Richard. We may have to pick that up our next session. But yeah, clearly the status quo conventional policies are now they're getting diminishing returns. You know, they're basically failing, and so we're going to have to start supporting a reworking of the financial system away from central banks and the super wealthy. And we're going to have to be able to find ways to distribute opportunity and capital much more fairly, or we're going to have nation states unraveling, you know, domestically. Never mind the geopolitical concerns; they'll just be unraveling as they lose social cohesion. And so, personally, we all want to seek places that have social cohesion and cultural values. And local production of essentials. I mean, that's all we can do as individual households is seek out more resilient places to live and find places that we can contribute to.
Yes, exactly. Wow, great insight and words of wisdom, Charles. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at uptominds.com. Samples of all my books are available for free, and all my archives are free.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.